This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Tessa Hadley read her story, Dido's Lament, from the August 8th and 15th issue of the magazine. Tessa Hadley has published 6 novels and 4 story collections, including Sunstroke and Other Stories and Married Love. She won this year's Wyndham Campbell Prize for fiction. Now here's Tessa Hadley.
Dido's Lament. Lynette was on Oxford Street, which was a stupid place to be at any time, and especially at 5 o'clock on a winter afternoon. It was her own fault. She'd gone into John Lewis after work for a few things she needed, and then she'd tried on some clothes which she hadn't meant to, and now she was stuck in a crowd of other shoppers and workers, fuming inwardly and shuffling in half steps, funneling into the entrance to the underground. Everybody was shapeless, muffled in down coats, hooded. Sleet was blowing in their faces. No one looked up at the Christmas lights. Lynette had heard someone say that one of the shops was pumping artificial snow into the street, which made the idea of even real snow somehow disgusting. Lynette was tall, anxious, original, in her late 30s, with coffee-coloured freckled skin. Her hair was shaved above her ears, and the rest of it, dyed bronze and pink, was piled up in a striking bird's nest mess, into which soft spatters of sleet blew and melted. She was wearing a red tartan scarf with a wool coat she'd found in a charity shop, bright pink with a big shawl collar, and believed that she despised the kind of clothes you could buy in department stores like John Lewis. It humiliated her to be caught out in this queue, branded with her own plastic carrier, stupid like everyone else. A man came pushing through the crowd from behind her, accidentally striking her hard with his shoulder as he passed, sending her staggering on her high heels. Lynette stumbled sideways, grabbing at a teenage boy hunched in a thin jacket, and then tripped against the wheels of a pushchair, only just stopping herself from falling on top of the child inside it. She was shocked out of her self-possession, her ankle wrenched painfully, the hem of her pink coat dragging in the dirty slush. A small stir of commiseration opened around her. Someone helped her to right herself, and the child's mother reassured the child, who began to cry. "No, I'm fine, I'm okay," Lynette said. "Sorry, thank you, sorry." The people behind them, meanwhile, were pressing inexorably forward. And the culprit, who'd pushed her, was forging on through the crowd, oblivious of any trouble he'd left in his wake. "Hey, you!" Lynette shouted at his back, but he didn't hear her or turn around. As soon as she was steady on her feet, she went hurrying after him, pushing furiously herself between trudging individuals, consumed by her rage at this retreating back in its mid-length tobacco-brown coat, which was swinging open in spite of the weather. The man had his hands carelessly in his pockets. Out of sheer stubbornness, Lynette refused to limp on the hurt ankle, wouldn't allow anyone to see that she was wounded. The tearing hot pain every time she put her weight on it seemed inseparable from her injured amour propre. She couldn't bear the picture of her own foolishness, the idiotic ugliness of her stumbling sideways hanging on to strangers. Suddenly, she hated this afternoon. This whole day, her whole life. The idea of her own separateness from others was essential to Lynette's dignity. She held herself apart from the mainstream. Ahead of her, the tobacco coat dipped down the stairs into the underground, and she followed after it, wouldn't take her eyes off it, couldn't forgive it. Something about that turned back infuriated her. Its broad, unconscious strength. Its serene unawareness of her. They were all funnelled in together again, through the ticket barriers, and she felt for her Oyster card in the side pocket of her bag without looking so as not to lose sight of her man. He was halfway down the escalator to the northbound platforms before she got on at the top. She wanted the Victoria line, and at the bottom he turned right for the Bakerloo, but she wouldn't let him go, until she'd said something and had some acknowledgement from him. So she followed him onto the platform, but couldn't see him at first. Then, there he was, back still presented to her, making his way along the platform to the other end. She pushed through the crowd behind him until she was close enough to touch the heavy weave of his coat, could almost feel the heat he radiated, smell the sweet-sour wool. Lynette put out her hand to tug at his arm and make him turn around to accuse him. "Excuse me," she began indignantly. Perhaps it was as soon as she touched him, before he turned around, that she knew it was Toby. It wasn't really so extraordinary that she'd followed him all that way without recognising him. She'd seen only his back, and the open flapping coat had obscured his shape. A knitted hat had hidden his hair. Anyway, Toby had changed a lot, filled out and become more definitely heavily his good-natured self in the years, 9 years, since she'd last seen him. She realised in that moment, to her surprise, that he'd been only a boy when they separated and then were divorced. They had seemed so ancient to themselves in those awful days, so darkened and wizened by experience and bitterness. It hadn't quite occurred to her in the time since they'd parted, and the parting had been all her doing. He had just suffered it intensely with a white, fixed, wronged stare and outbreaks of baffled protest, that he might have had all this growing left to do. Toby wasn't exactly better looking now. In fact, he'd never really been her type, which might have been part of the problem. He still had that sandy colouring, his nose raw and pink with cold, something naked in his face, knobbed cheekbones and cracked lips, bony forehead. She guessed that his reddish fair hair had receded quite some way underneath the hat. But he had more force now than he used to have, as if his bones had thickened and hardened. Something unfinished in his face had been completed and closed. At the sight of her, however, his expression cracked open into such spontaneous, friendly pleasure that it was like a flare against the underground light. "Lynette, what are you doing here?" A train was arriving. As the crowd surged forward, he grabbed her with both hands hanging onto her sleeves so that he wouldn't lose her, smiling into her face. They let the train go. "The same as you, stupid," she said, returning his smile. "Living here." "I thought you'd gone abroad." "I did, but I came back." Still holding on to her, Toby looked around him as if he'd been so preoccupied that he'd hardly taken the trouble until now to notice where he was. "Listen, this is no good. Let's get out of here to talk." "But it's hell up there, too." "Then where are you going to get off? Where is it you live? I'll get off with you and we'll find somewhere for coffee or for a drink. It's really good to see you." The old Toby, the young one, had been very shy. He'd had the air of a country boy, which in a way he was. He'd grown up in a dilapidated farmhouse, though his parents weren't farmers, but artists. But how worldly he appeared now. He seemed to know how to take command of their time and arrange for their pleasure. And if he was inviting her out for a drink, Lynette thought, then he had surely forgiven her for the past. He had got over her, just as she'd promised him he would, though she hadn't actually been quite sure. She'd been afraid that he was one of those men who were marked for life when they were hurt. But that fear had only been her vanity, after all. Naturally, he'd forgotten her. She knew that she wouldn't ever tell him now about how he'd sent her flying and she'd come vengefully after him. "I'm meeting friends later in Marylebone," she lied. "I'm sure we can find somewhere there for a drink. I'm free till 8. On the train, there was no chance of a seat. Standing, pressed tightly against each other, among all the wet coats, still smiling into each other's smiles, leaning in to confide. Lynette was tall enough to speak into his ear, even though Toby was 6'3" or 4. and swaying together, hanging on to the bar overhead. They talked with a warmth and ease they might not have managed seated side by side. If Lynette inclined against him, she could take the weight off her ankle. Anyway, she hardly noticed the pain. She was too full of her own performance, confident, forceful, charming. "You've changed," she said to Toby. "I've just realised what it is. You look prosperous." Laughing, he blushed. So at least he still blushed easily. "I am prosperous," he said. "Moderately prosperous. Things have gone pretty well these past few years. Do I sound smug? The studios are getting plenty of work. We've set up a new production company to develop some more innovative projects. We can afford to take a few risks now. And what about you? You look the same as ever." "Not prosperous, you mean?" "You know what I mean," he said flatteringly, but easily, as if her looks and his pleasure in her looks didn't dismay him as they once had. "Well, she wasn't prosperous," she said. "She had a temp job in admin at the BBC. It was hardly temping. She'd been there almost a year. It paid the bills, although, of course, in London it didn't really pay the bills. But she didn't care about money. He knew that. She had everything she wanted. She was still singing. Her parents were fine, both alive, both still working. Her mother was a nurse, and her dad, whose own father had come from Sierra Leone, was driving for a private car hire firm. He'd finished with the buses. "And have you married again, Toby?" she asked him. She thought she felt the faintest wincing in him then, thrumming through his body like a dull bass note. But she might have been imagining it. In his face, she couldn't see anything but bright openness. "I thought you'd have heard about Jazz," he said. "We've got two little girls. We're very happy." "I did hear something. I'm so glad you're happy." "What about you?" "Oh, remember what I told you. I'm not really the marrying kind, or the mothering kind either." "Never say never." "I've got a nice boyfriend," she added, which was another lie or a half-lie, particularly that word, boyfriend, which she would never normally have used about the man she saw sometimes, a musician who was thoroughly wrapped up in his own work. Toby was carefully tactful. "I don't blame you about the mothering. It's good, but very messy, not much sleep." When the train jolted and he put an arm round Lynette's shoulders to steady her, she imagined that their bodies, separated by all the layers of their winter clothes, were sniffing each other out, old familiars, remembering each other's nakedness and all the daily closeness and lust and shame that, in the comedy played out by their conscious selves, they must pretend not to remember. "I've got a suggestion, by the way," he said. "All the bars will be packed. It's a nightmare pre-Christmas. We could go back to my place in Queen's Park and have a drink there instead. More peaceful. I'd like you to see it." The last thing Lynette wanted was to meet his wife. She could imagine her already without meeting her. She knew what she looked like from Facebook, small and blonde and sparky, flexible from her Pilates, hostile. "Really? Wouldn't I just be in the way? Isn't it the children's tea time and all that?" "Oh, they're off visiting Jazz's sister. I've got the house to myself." That was startling. How worldly was he, coolly inviting her to trespass on the grounds of his second marriage? Lynette even wondered for a mad moment whether she'd made Toby wicked when she left him, whether he'd learned from her how to have his own secrets and calculate for his own devious purposes. She studied his open, hopeful expression, cautiously, as if she were just musing over the timing of her imaginary arrangements for later, but couldn't catch any flicker of suggestiveness or sin. Probably what she'd concluded all those years ago still held. If she was too complicated, he was too simple. Perhaps he believed that they could have their innocence back as if there'd never been anything between them. "All right, why not?" she said. "I'm curious to see where you've ended up." The house, a whole house, he really was prosperous, fronted right onto Queen's Park, so that at both ends of the long sitting room on the first floor, you looked out onto bare winter trees, a tracery of wet branches gleaming black in the reflected light from the windows. Toby went around switching on lamps, but didn't draw the curtains, and so the room was filled with their awareness of the thin city darkness outside, and the rushing sound of the rain, which had begun to fall in earnest. He knelt to put a match to the kindling in the wood-burning stove. Lynette was taking in the distinctive, comfortable, expensive room, well lived in, and its idiosyncratic mixture of old things and modern ones. A worn leather sofa with scuffed cushions, smouldering red rugs on the dark polished boards, some kind of ancient silk applique on one wall, a painted rocking horse, piles of children's books, toys, an elliptical smoked glass coffee table, a Bose hi-fi, shelves stacked with vinyl. "Oh, I'd like to stay here," she thought, before she could stop herself. She was dead tired. It had been a long day. Toby shook out the match, and behind the bleary stove window, young white flames sucked and stretched as sinuously as animals. "You've trailed your coat in the mud," he noticed, still kneeling, picking up her hem and frowning at it. Lynette saw with a pang the patch on his crown where the hair was sparse. "We ought to put it to dry," he said, "then you can brush it off before you go out again." Pretending to see the mud for the first time, she told him not to fuss, it didn't matter, but he insisted on carrying off the coat to hang it somewhere warm. There had always been a mismatch between the rugged form of him, knotty biceps and big, coarse, freckled hands, and the delicate way he touched things and fretted over them. Lynette remembered that this scrupulous solicitousness of his had goaded her into bad behaviour. It had made her careless and wasteful, afraid that his loving kindness might enclose her too entirely like a sheath. Left alone in his sitting room, she stood stubbornly without exploring, putting her weight on her good foot, rubbing her long, tapering hands together, palms yellow with cold, nails painted dark maroon, in the heat that was only just starting to come from the stove. She heard a reassuring rush of life into the central heating system, which Toby must have turned on, radiators ticking as they began to warm up. When he returned, he'd taken off his coat and was carrying two glasses of white wine, the glass faintly green, stems twisted like barley sugar. She tapped one with her nail, making it ring. "Is white all right?" he asked. "You used to like it." In the old days, he was always anxiously searching her face to see whether she liked things or didn't like them. His subordination to her will had dragged at her, making her resentful. Now, she couldn't see past some new barrier in his eyes, as if behind it he were placid and settled, hardened. "I still do," she said. "What a lovely place." He glanced around him proprietorially, pleased. "Do you approve?" "You've got your mother's good taste. I don't mean exactly the same taste as hers, but the same confidence and good instincts. I thought I was going to discover things about Jazz when I came in here, but I can't feel her anywhere." "Jazz isn't interested in her surroundings, so long as everything's comfortable. She can't believe what a big deal I make out of choosing stuff. She's like you. Everything's in the inner life." Displeased, Lynette tapped on her glass again, drumming a rhythm, turning away from him to look at an old clock with an enamelled face painted with dancing cupids telling the wrong time. "This is a nice piece," she said randomly, though she hated the simpering pink cupids. Why did men always do that? run their women together into a continuum. Had Toby forgotten Lynette so thoroughly, or had he never known her? How could he not see that she and Jazz were opposites who would dislike each other on sight? On Facebook, at least before the babies, Lynette had stopped looking afterward, Jazz was usually huddled with a crowd of similar-looking friends, fellow schoolteachers perhaps, their arms round one another's necks. They were all grinning, and one of them might have her eyes crossed or be sticking her tongue out. Sometimes they were wearing funny hats or set against the backdrop of a foreign city. When she first saw the photos, Lynette understood that Toby had opted for an easier, chummier life, turning his back on certain kinds of difficulty. And why not? She sat down in one corner of the leather sofa, with Toby at an angle to her, their knees almost touching, in a low chair covered in striped velvet. He had been right to bring her here. In the anonymity of a bar somewhere, they'd have fallen easily into a surface flirtation under her control. Here, in his family home, everything was transparent and therefore went deeper. How could they be strangers now, when they were so intimate once? They had belonged to each other in their youth. Her eyes filled with tears unexpectedly at the idea of it. The wine was very cold, delicious. Her body was relaxing in the thickening warmth of the room while the clarifying alcohol flashed through her blood like ice. Reminiscing, avoiding treacheries, she and Toby seemed to be treading on safe stepping stones above dark, flowing water. He was sorry he hadn't kept in touch with her brothers. Such lovely guys, they used to seem super cool to him. They were a nightmare, Lynette said. They'd been in all sorts of trouble, but were settled now. One painting and decorating, one in the police, you know, poacher turned gamekeeper, what a joke. And how was his mother? Lynette knew about the cancer, was it still in remission? Carol wasn't so well, Toby said. She was having more chemo. Lynette touched the back of his hand kindly, lightly with her long fingers. "Do you remember our car crash?" she said. "On the way home from your parents' house, when that white juggernaut was almost on top of us on the motorway because he didn't see us in his blind spot. Clipped our back end when you tried to accelerate ahead of him. I really thought we were going to die. And all that time, while we went spinning across into three lanes of oncoming traffic, all that time you were just talking to me very quietly in your normal voice, telling me everything was going to be all right. It was very calming. No, that isn't what you said exactly. You were just saying, nothing's happened yet. It's all right so far. Nothing's happened yet. Nothing did happen, Toby said stoutly. But we could have died tragically young like lovers in a story. He laughed. I'm glad we didn't die. Lynette was watching all the time for any little clue that gave away what was missing from his new life. And she was changing her mind about his looks. The raw sweetness Toby had once had was solidified now into authority. He was substantial and massive, without self-doubt. In the firelight, the wiry hair on his forearms and the down on his ruddy cheekbones had a russet glow. She'd felt distaste in the past for that gingery colouring. Now, it seemed like a signal sent up from Toby's passionate secret life from which she was shut out. Checking his watch, he worried about her friends in Marylebone. Though I wish you could stay longer. Yes, I ought to go soon. She was running her finger around the rim of her glass, making it ring out. Why couldn't he guess that those friends didn't exist? Tell me about your singing, Toby said. Then, Lynette was flooded with all the anguish that music entailed for her. It made her sick that he knew about certain things she'd rather forget. How ambitious she'd been, and the grand idea of her talent that she'd once cherished and had since discarded. Her voice hadn't been as good as she'd hoped. She had failed to make a career out of it. although she did do some teaching, hourly paid, and also some examining for the Associated Board. Turning her face away, she presented him with her haughtiest profile. "Oh, that. I'm in a show at the moment. You know I'm superstitious. I don't want to talk about it." "And you have felt free. You told me that as long as we were together, you weren't free to give yourself over to your work completely." "Did I say that? How pretentious of me." She felt a spasm of exasperation that Toby had stored up all the nonsense she'd ever spoken and taken it so seriously. In fact, she was guesting in a student production of Dido and Aeneas, in which Aeneas was got up as the captain of an American football team and Dido as a cheerleader. It worked surprisingly well. Toby didn't know anything about music anyway. Lynette hummed to herself the opening lines of Dido's lament as she looked around the beautiful room. How strange that Toby was so simple. And yet his simplicity had had all these solid, complicated effects in the real world, these material accumulations and accretions, and children too, the branching out and infinite complication of children. Whereas her own complexity seemed to have had no consequences. It was all wrapped up inside her. She had nothing to show for it. She didn't even own anything significant. Toby hunted for a stiff brush in the utility room. While he worked with it over the sink, getting the mud off her pink coat, Lynette idled in the spacious kitchen, stroking the dark teak surfaces, rattling the drawers open and closing them, so many gadgets, and admiring the children's photos and drawings stuck to the fridge and on the cupboard doors. What gorgeous little girls! Finally, holding her coat up to the light, he was satisfied. "You can't see any trace of it." "Here's my number," Lynette said, scribbling it on a board that was already chalked with pasta, calpol, kitchen towel, black olives. "Text me, so I get yours. It's been so nice catching up. I'd like to stay in touch." "I'd like it too. You ought to meet Jazz sometime. That would be nice." It was still raining hard, but she wouldn't take an umbrella. "I don't mind getting wet," she called back from the steps outside his front door, laughing up at him. "It's lovely. I love the rain." They were waving and smiling. Lynette turned to go. And just as Toby closed the door behind her, abruptly stopping up the flood of light from inside, she put her weight down clumsily on her sprained ankle, missing the bottom step and slipping heavily on the wet stone. She cried out and grabbed at the railing that ran in front of the basement area. Toby couldn't hear her from inside the house. A man hurrying past with his collar pulled up against the weather chose not to turn around. The street lights seemed all but obliterated by the falling rain. Tall trees in the gated park reproached her with their penitential stillness. Everything was desolation. It was too much. Hot tears of pain and self-pity mixed with the cold rain on Lynette's cheeks. But she couldn't climb the steps to that front door again. Although she longed for the warmth stoked up inside, the flames licking in Toby's stove. As if the pain had summoned it, she remembered a scene quite unlike all the steadying, consoling stories that she and Toby had exchanged upstairs. It was when everything was almost over between them, and she was putting her things into boxes. She hadn't wanted to take much, only a few essential CDs and clothes. She had pretended to be busy with the boxes, but her hands were shaking and she hardly knew what she was packing, and Toby's ranting behind her was terrible because it was so uncharacteristic, as if something in him that should never have come to light had been broken open and exposed. "Take whatever you like," he said. "Everything you've touched is spoiled for me now." Toby stood for a moment with his back to the closed door, not thinking or processing anything, then returned to the kitchen. He had work to do this evening. He ought to make a sandwich or an omelette and get on with it. He checked his phone, and then he noticed Lynette's number written on the chalkboard. After a moment's hesitation, he erased the number with a wet cloth, wiped the whole board clean, then rewrote pasta, Calpol, kitchen towel, black olives. He washed out the cloth and ran tap water in the sink, rinsing away the dried mud he'd brushed off her coat, sending it spinning down the plug hole. When he took his omelette upstairs to eat it in front of the 24-hour news, the first thing he saw was her forgotten plastic carrier tucked underneath the sofa where she'd been sitting. He ate the omelette without tasting anything, not taking his eyes off the TV screen. And then when he'd finished eating, he put down his plate and picked up the carrier gingerly without opening it or looking inside. Perplexed, he stood holding it stiffly away from his body. He'd have liked to bury it deep in a dustbin somewhere outside, perhaps on the next street, only he couldn't do that in case Lynette came back to ask for it. And now that he'd erased her number, he couldn't even text her to ask for her address so that he could post the thing, get rid of it. The item incriminated him, whatever he did. Eventually, he hid it at the back of one of the cabinets in his office upstairs. Toby wasn't a natural deceiver, and he hadn't done anything that wasn't innocent. But it would be better if Jazz didn't know that Lynette had been here in this house, printing her presence everywhere so that it haunted him wherever he looked. If Jazz didn't know, then he didn't have to think about what it meant. Jazz called, but he didn't pick up his phone or ring her back. He wasn't ready to talk to her, not yet. He was deliberately not thinking something. He wasn't thinking that he'd put everything together, family and work and home, all so that Lynette could visit it some day and see that he'd managed to have a good life without her. He knew that if he held off from thinking that for long enough, then at some point it could no longer possibly be true, and he'd forget that he'd ever thought it might be. Lynette managed to limp to a chilly, empty pub around the corner where no one was watching the football on gigantic screens. She bought another glass of wine, which wasn't a good idea because it wasn't anything like as nice as the wine she'd had at Toby's, and anyway, two glasses always gave her a headache. Halfway through her drink, she remembered the silky top she'd bought because it was reduced and must have left behind in his house with its price tag still attached in its plastic carrier. She imagined Toby pulling out the slinky leopard skin print and examining it, surprised by how cheap it was, sorry that Lynette couldn't afford anything better, wondering if she wasn't too old to wear it. At least he was bound to text her now, as soon as he discovered that she'd forgotten it. She put her phone on the tabletop in front of her and waited. Would she tell him that she'd hurt herself? That she was still close by? I'm just around the corner. Bit of a disaster. I've done something silly to my ankle. She didn't know yet. She waited to see what words he chose to use. She might not tell him anything. Might not even get back to him at all, in fact. She might just take an Uber home. It really was better to be free. Or, if it wasn't better, it was necessary.
That was Tessa Hadley reading her story, Dido's Lament. She's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 2002. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on newyorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Alice Madison reads The First American by Laurie Siegel. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.